Welcome to Confessions of an Entrepreneur / Founder. My name is Carl Swansbury, and I'm delighted today to have Jeremy Middleton on my podcast. For those of you watching who don't know Jeremy, let me just give you a very brief introduction to Jeremy's background. Jeremy started his career at Procter & Gamble as a professional marketeer before deciding, alongside his colleague then and friend Richard Harpen, to set up HomeServe. The journey of HomeServe was long, many ups, downs, and of course, significant hurdles to overcome. But of course, for anyone who has observed the HomeServe journey, HomeServe from startup to a point in time whereby the business transacted, got to a valuation of just north of $5 billion. And of course, Richard as CEO and Jeremy as non-exec director, both were significant shareholders up until that transactional point. Since then, Jeremy has gone on to found a private equity vehicle, Middleton Enterprises, through which Jeremy invests in a number of founder-led businesses across a range of sectors, including Sushi Dog, which is a national sushi chain, One Gym, which is a significant low-cost gym operator here in the northeast of England, to name a few. I don't know Jeremy very well, so I'm personally really looking forward to today's podcast, but for sure, given his significant success, given the number of sectors in which he's invested in, and in turn, the number of businesses he has supported over the years, I think today we're going to receive a number of really interesting insights, which I think we can all leverage day to day in our businesses. Jeremy, first of all, can I just thank you for giving up your time this morning to get together and join me on my Confessions of an Entrepreneur / Investor podcast.
Very happy to be here.
And of course, I've known of you, Jeremy, for many, many years as a high-profile, very successful businessman and investor. And only recently have I personally, along with my firm, had the pleasure of advising you on one of your recent refinancings. So I was delighted when you kindly took the invite to appear on my podcast this morning. So
great.
Thank you.
Let's go.
So I guess for the benefit of not only our viewers, Jeremy, but actually for myself, given we've not spent a lot of time together socially, it would be fascinating just to understand a little bit more about your early upbringing, given, of course, you aren't from the Northeast, are you? So could you just take us back to sort of your childhood and just tell us a little bit about your upbringing and education, Jeremy?
Okay, well, I was brought up, my father worked in a bank, he was a bank manager. So we moved around a lot in the Midlands. I was brought up mainly in Wolverhampton nothing particularly remarkable about it. But I have to say when I left...
Do you mean your upbringing or Wolverhampton?
There's nothing remarkable about Wolverhampton, I can tell you. So, I left at 17 and apart from visiting my parents, never came back.
Yeah.
But it's like everything. You always love the town where you're from.
Of course you do.
Until you get a bit more perspective when you leave it. It did mean that when I came to Newcastle as a young guy, I knew where I found a much better place to live. I enjoy it much more.
And of course, I know that your pull to the Northeast was Procter & Gamble. But before we move on to that, could we just talk a little bit about your education and what positioned you to be able to apply for a role at Procter & Gamble?
Okay. Well, the answer is not much. To be fair, I did go to university and I got a history degree. I applied to Kent in Canterbury because it was easy to get in, if I'm honest with you, a few other reasons. If I'd applied from university, I wouldn't have got in because they recruited from places like Oxbridge. They didn't come to Canterbury. My academic results were nothing particularly outstanding. But I got a job in a bank after I graduated and I was useless at it. I hated it. They equally thought I was useless. It clearly wasn't going very well. I saw an advert in a newspaper in the Sunday Times it was for marketing. I thought I might be better at that. Doesn't involve adding up to the same.
Absolutely.
I didn't really look where it was. I got on the train because I got an interview for a starter position in Newcastle. And as I got halfway up, I thought, there's no way I'm coming up here. I mean, I've been traveling forever. I don't know anybody in Newcastle. But I got there and they offered me a job on the spot.
Wow.
And I was bowled over and I thought, yeah, let's go for it. I haven't really got anything to lose. So I didn't plan to come to Newcastle. I came here because I got a job offer with a great company. And I stayed because I love the place.
And obviously you mentioned that straight out of university, you got a job at a bank.
Yeah.
Was that in any way sort of the encouragement / inspiration of your father, given your father was a bank?
Yeah.
And you
know, the truth was I went to the careers service and I went through all the brochures and found out who paid the most. And they were marketing companies, oil companies and banks. And I applied for them all. And then I actually got elected president of my students' union, and it was a sabbatical year. So I applied to them all, said, can I defer entry? And they all said no, apart from Barclays Bank.
Right.
So then I never really got round to doing anything else because I had a job lined up there. So I went, not knowing anything about banking at all. And it was completely unsuitable for me. It was, again, just chance.
And when you were at university in Canterbury, did you live on campus or did you sort of commute? How did that work?
Okay, well, a bit of both. I partly went there because it was a campus university. I wanted to experience that. By the way, I also went there because I thought the weather was fine. It was a long way away from Wolverhampton and there was a high ratio of women to men. So all of which it was designed to say, and it's an easy course. I thought I'd have a nice life.
Right, I see the
attraction. So I went for non-academic reasons, just as many people did in those times. If you got a chance to go to university, it was just a chance.
Sure.
And I think life was a lot easier then if you were lucky enough to get on that path because you then thought you'd get a graduate job. And indeed, I did get a graduate job. That only gets you so far, of course.
Of course it does.
But that's what happened.
And this is partly a rhetorical question, but I should ask it for completeness.
Okay.
Why history?
Oh, because I was interested in doing, at school, I wanted to do economics, but they said, no, you don't do economics. You're quite good academically. You should do Latin. Latin has been really useful to me. Sorry. And then when I got to A levels, I said, I'd like to do economics. No, you don't do economics. You do arts subjects because they're the ones you did at your O levels. And then when I came to university, I wanted to do business studies. You don't do business studies at university. That's what they do at polytechnics. So, that's the truth. That was the way it was. I think it still is up to a point. So a lot of people who don't know, and most of us don't know as a kid, get steered into whatever's the next step up from school. And that's often, humanities subjects. So yes, I thought history was quite interesting. I'm still interested in history, but I mean, it wasn't a useful thing for me. Or society for me to study it.
Totally. Yeah, totally.
Tell you the truth. When I really wanted to learn about stuff.
Isn't it really interesting to hear that in each instance, as you went through education, your actual interest, your true passion, which was business economics, was completely suppressed by the lecturers and teachers around you. I mean, how fascinating is that as a concept?
It wasn't encouraged. My father was a professional, as it were, rather than an entrepreneur. And I didn't know any entrepreneurs or business people around me particularly, but I was always interested. We could debate why, but whether it was just to earn a bit more money. And as a kid, I had a car cleaning business and a few other things, but small beer.
Yes.
But I was always attracted to the idea. I always thought I wanted to do it.
Yeah, understand. And before we talk about, I guess, your relocation to the Toon, and for those viewers who don't understand what that means, I meant Newcastle. You mentioned that obviously your parents aren't entrepreneurs, aren't sort of business owners. Where do you think that sort of itch to create something and to get on financially does come from? Because normally it's inspired by something we see or someone we spend time with. So where do you think it does come from? Because it's not your parents, it seems.
I don't know. It's just my own experiences were I didn't like working for other people.
No.
I didn't like being assessed, although I entirely understand why you do get assessed.
Yes.
And I particularly didn't like it if I wasn't assessed very well. That's right. So one way out of that was to work for yourself. Doing any, you either don't need to be doing, well, you do get assessed, but you can see that in the numbers. But either way, you can't blame anyone else. So I just didn't enjoy it. Whereas I loved the freedom and creativity, the decision-making that you make yourself when you are effectively self-employed, notwithstanding the other constraints that sort of...
Sure, which will definitely come on.
You have to make a living, of course.
So tell me, so obviously you got a role at Procter & Gamble in marketing, meaning calculator could be put into the top drawer for the short...
Well, we used it a little bit, but at least I understood it a bit.
Exactly. And you relocated to Newcastle.
Yeah.
And as you say, no friends and family in the Northeast. Yeah. Just talk to me a little bit about how difficult it was to physically move yourself north.
It was perfectly easy. I didn't own anything. I just came up here, did the usual, which is look for a flat share. Found one in Heaton. Got the box room. Went down the road to the secondhand shop and bought the mattress. Stuck it on the ground. There I was. Went to work.
Awesome.
Which is quite normal.
Totally. That's right.
Newcastle was great because there were other people starting of the same age in the same place.
Yeah, which is great, isn't it? In terms of a media group.
And work was full on because it was interesting. I'd worked a bit before, unlike most of the others who were just graduate starters.
Right, okay.
And I knew what a crap job was. So I also knew what a good job was. And I also knew I couldn't afford to fail again. So broadly, I worked as hard as I could. As soon as I enjoyed it, that was great. So, and in Procter, I learned such a lot because they had a structured approach to running a business and they gave a lot of responsibility early on. And you're encouraged to think, act, lead, make proposals, analyze, as opposed to just feeling like a cog in a machine. Yeah. So maybe I was lucky at the time, but I thought it was a great job. I just loved it.
And there's a lot to be said, isn't there, for working away from home? Because actually, as you say, because you don't have friends, family is a distraction. You do put yourself into everything because you have the time and you don't have the same demands outside of business, do you?
Well, I was just a single guy then, so I didn't
exactly
have any problems. And there were other people in the same boat around. And Newcastle's a great place to be a young person.
Yeah, I'm not even going to ask about, what you guys as a year group got on.
Oh, we worked very hard.
Well, I can imagine you did work hard in and out of for hours, for sure. So just talk to me about sort of ultimately what you achieved and what you learned at P&G and what that has gave you as you've moved through your business career, Jeremy. Actually picked on some of the things.
Yeah, I think an understanding of, well, you can call it marketing, but it's really defined as meeting customer needs profitably, i.e. it's running a business. And they gave you an overall feeling for all parts of the marketing mix. They gave you an understanding of how you lead, and they gave you basic business disciplines, how to write, how to communicate, how to analyze, and how to develop strategy. Oh. At quite a young age. So I would call it giving responsibility early. I mean, it was great. I remember if you wrote a view on something that should be done, a recommendation, and that might go to a very senior level, right the way up to the MD of the company with your name on it. And if it was approved, it came back all the way down the line to you that you had done that.
Yeah,
so you weren't working for some other guy to get the credit.
It's a repurpose.
You were the guy that got the credit. And therefore, if you could see opportunities, then you felt it was rewarding.
Yes.
And I'd worked bluntly what I thought, I worked for a British company before, which I thought was stuffy and old and constraining and constrictive. And I felt I was working, this was an American level, a company that was equal in its treatment of people, anxious to encourage young talent. It was an entirely different culture. And I think, a lot of what you learn is about culture. I was only there a few years, but as far as being trained and formed, that's where it happens.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, of course, Procter & Gamble is a significant business. So you could be wrong in assuming that that therefore means, you know, there are layers and layers of bureaucracy. Yeah. You are 100 removed from a C-suite executive.
Yeah.
And perhaps, you know, you would be wrong to think that everything you do is put up to the person above you, who then effectively right. repurposes and takes credit. So it's phenomenal to hear how Procter & Gamble is such a big business, could act very entrepreneurially and actually truly empower people at all levels, because big corporates talk about it, but the reality is it's tough to achieve, isn't it?
And I'm sure it varies how well Procter does it.
Of course, of course.
But at that time, in this place,
it
worked really well.
Awesome.
And, there's a few of the friends and peers of mine who went through that particular marketing machine in Newcastle went on to build very successful careers.
So tell me, so when was it you decided that perhaps Procter & Gamble wasn't your sort of long-term career?
Mm.
What encouraged you to hang up your boots within the P&G environment?
Just an itch I needed to scratch. I knew that I wanted to try and be in business for myself. And I just knew that I had to try it. To be honest, I didn't think it would really benefit me to progress too much further up the food chain of a big company, because it'd just make it harder to leave.
Yeah.
A lot of people get into this position, you know, gosh, I'm starting to make some money, I'm getting responsibilities. That makes it harder for people to leave. So I wanted to make it happen. I'd actually got relocated to Cairo in Egypt, where I was marketing manager there for Procter. And after I'd been there a year, and sort of just thinking about it, lying on a beach, is this the career? Oh, not while I was working. I'm never going to own my own soap company. So how do I do it? I don't know. I'm going to quit. I'm going to come back to Newcastle and I'm going to find a way to start up in business.
And is that what you did? You resigned without any real knowledge as to what was coming next?
Well, no, no.
Other than your own.
I'm not that risk averse. I mean, and that was the plan. But I resigned and got a job in consultancy with PwC up here, the marketing consultancy. And at the same time, my friend Richard Harpin, who worked with me at Procter & Gamble on the Fairy Liquid brand, also resigned from Procter and did the same thing with then Cooper's Lybrout. And we did it with a view to, well, maybe we'll learn something in consultancy, but, you know, it'll be a stepping stone, because we're going to go find something to do in business together.
And to be clear, I mean, were you absolutely both 100% committed on these moves being a stepping stone to setting up a business? Was
yes.
that absolutely
yeah,
the
yeah.
case?
There's no intention of building a career.
Right, okay.
We did a proper job for the people who employed
us. Of course, totally. But you knew it was going to be a means to an end.
We knew it was only a means to an end. From the moment we arrived, we were looking, saying, how do we get into business?
Yes. And obviously, one of the biggest challenges in business is making sure the people you go into business with you can trust, are capable, and will perhaps bring something that you don't have yourself. Because,
yeah.
of course, it's about leveraging everyone's skills. Why Richard? Because, of course, you will have had many friends at that time and many colleagues who you could have peered with. Why did you and Richard gel?
Because we did have the same objectives.
Well,
both wanted to do that, whereas most people wanted to just get promoted at work.
Sure, they would just look the ladder.
Or they would think they want to do it, but not really. So there was a determination to do it. There was a track record of having a go at things.
Yeah.
So Richard had run and was running several businesses whilst he was still at Procter.
Right. Okay.
On the side. I too had been, we'd both been buying into the early stages of the buy-to-let concepts and buying houses individually. And indeed, that was the first thing we did was let us combine resources and do both of those things.
Right. So you had buy-to-let properties together.
Yep. Those were the days when you could get 100% mortgage. Go
sure.
and buy a
good old Northern Rock.
A property, fill it with tenants, and then go and buy another one.
Mm.
We built quite a few that way. But whilst we were at Procter, this was still going on. You know, all the calls were coming in, and we thought we can't really hold down jobs while all of this lot is going on.
Yes.
So we went and hired somebody to set up a letting agency.
Understand.
And that became a business. But this was while we were still employed.
But that was the first time you had a dare I say, proper business together.
Yes.
You know, by letting
absolutely
agents.
Yeah, so we hired a great lady, Jane Dixon, who we actually interviewed her. We said, we want to know what you like. We'll interview you in your flat in Jesmond. And after this, it's great, great news. You've got the job. And by the way, this is where the office is going to be. Because we didn't have an office. But we were only hiring her at that time for 20 hours a week.
Sure.
At a modest sum. But and that grew into the letting agency. Because once we were managing our own properties and then we started to take on other clients, it became professional properties on Acorn Road. And I was managing about 600 properties by the end.
Oh. Over what period of time?
Several years.
And did you sell that business? What happened?
No. I mean, we set that business up and a good number of related businesses. And like most of the businesses we're involved in, we're quite good at generating sales, but we weren't very good at making any money.
Right.
In the end, we passed it on to someone else, but there was no big exit.
Right. Okay. Understand.
Yeah, it was one of a number of businesses that were set up, traded, had ambitions for, grew, did our best, but didn't really have a competitive edge. I think the main thing that I learned from those early years is it's not enough just to trade. You absolutely have to find something which you are better than anyone else at in your business model. Otherwise, you can be pretty constrained on where you get to.
Mm-hmm. I think we'll come on to that, actually, because sometimes people believe that they have an edge or they believe that they have USPs. But as you and I both know, often it's just a regurgitation of what already exists, right? And therefore, business has become me too. But we'll come back to that.
Yeah.
So obviously, you and Richard both resigned from the bosom of Procter & Gamble.
Yeah.
You know, you went into Big Four Consultancy,
yeah.
Two separate firms, but probably doing similar things. And I suspect Sundays, you know, were when you did the proper business, i.e. your businesses together. So how long did you work within Big Four Consulting for before you decided, you know what, we've now got what we need to do this?
About 18 months.
So not long.
No, not long. And Richard left first. We did a deal, actually, on a handshake, which lasted us right the way through, which is we'll do this in partnership together. We got to be in the business. You can't be outside it. But we didn't have an income stream to match that. So we said, well, we share everything 50-50. Whatever we make in profits or in earnings from jobs, we'll share 50-50. So Richard, he leaves first, but I'll keep working until we've got to a position where I can leave as well.
Oh, and you were giving Richard half of your salary?
Effect, yes.
Yep. Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah.
And how did you, sorry to interrupt you, Jeremy, just to ask us, that's not something that most people would perhaps have agreed to as a concept. Why is it you both trusted each other so explicitly? Because, of course, you weren't brothers, you aren't related. Where did that sort of absolute understanding and trust come from?
It was win-win for both of us.
Yeah.
I mean, we believed each other.
Yeah.
But you could see why.
Mm.
We both wanted it to work. Having a sounding board is important for both of us. It just doesn't make sense for us both to quit. How are we going to pay for all of that? It makes much more sense that one goes and then the other. I mean, in the end, I don't think we really did get the income stream to match it, and I just quit as well.
Yeah. But the concept is
because we had so much going on, you were either in or you weren't.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because a lot of people, as you said earlier, find it difficult to resign from a big, well-paid job to pursue setting up a business. Because, of course, it's difficult to go from 10K per month to zero.
Mm.
But, of course, I guess the approach you and Richard were taking was, well, actually, you know, we can achieve both simultaneously if we do it as a pair.
I mean, I think it's an interesting concept. I mean, I think it becomes more interesting when you move it on, you know, right the way through to our deals in HomeServe and so on, where every aspect of our commercial relationship, we never put anything in paper. We never involved lawyers. We just did everything on a handshake.
There you are.
And when, including whenever we felt it's right to restructure our equity holdings for whatever reason, we'd just agree.
Yeah, well, yeah.
And you build confidence over time.
Of course you do. That's right. Trust
it. And also if it works.
Yeah. Well, that's right. And trust has to be earned. And, you know, I appreciate that. You know, I keep asking about how you were both just so at ease and so trusting of each other. And the answer is, you know, I guess experience.
Yes, he tried this. I mean, he'd tried with other business partners.
So you are.
And I'd tried with other business partners. And we both kept on trying.
Yeah.
Sometimes when you start, you learn to trust each other. But also, sometimes you don't have much choice.
Yes.
You know, once you've made your commitment together, you have to see it through together.
Yep.
Of course, you can always split up. But if you still believe in the concept and the idea and the person, then you stick with it.
Totally. So obviously you both resigned from your big four consultancy roles circa a year and a half, 2 years in. So just talk to me about where the idea for HomeServe came from. You know, what was the inspiration?
Oh, I'd love to say it was a great inspiration. In practice, what happened was we are running this a property letting agency.
Indeed.
Because of that, we've set up a number of other businesses which will be related.
Just so more the property.
Yeah, so there might be a cleaning business, an interior design business. There was a property repair business originally called Fast Fix. And because you get all these calls coming in, so things that need fixing. So why don't we run a business that fixes them? Guys in yellow bands call out within an hour, 24 hours a day. And that business was mainly plumbing.
Yeah, no.
So that's the operation that is running. But it was a loss-making plumbing business.
Mm. And were you employing through that business plumbers or were these self-employed tradesmen?
We were employed. So we bought two vans, we hired two guys, we sent them out, we put adverts in the yellow pages. It was an emergency planning business. And it grew sales, but, let's take it forward, but it costs cash.
Yeah.
Because, you've got to advertise to find the work, take the calls, quote for jobs.
That's right.
Do jobs, fix jobs, send an invoice, get paid.
Yeah, so all the friction in that business.
And we didn't really have good financial controls because that wasn't the world we came from. And we were losing money and we were burning cash, a lot of cash. Indeed, we didn't realize how much cash we were burning. And at one stage, we'd burnt our way through all our tenants' deposits, which would be illegal now but was not then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And once you've spent all those tenants' deposits, you know it would be if you hadn't been paid them.
That's right.
So then you're in a deep hole.
Yep.
And so then you want to raise money. Banks wouldn't lend to us. Venture capital wouldn't lend to us. Richard borrowed some money off his mother. We'd maxed out on our credit cards. We're doing deals with a Batman not to pay them. So that's how hairy it was getting.
Yeah, pretty bleak. From a cash perspective.
From a cash perspective. We're always believing, but you have to keep going. And you've always, like so many businesses, got this 3-month turnaround plan. This is how it's all going to come back. In the end, a number of things happened. First of all, we did find, Richard actually found a friend I'm still in business with, Simon Blunt, who lent us some money. So he actually lent us 15 grand.
Was that sort of as an investor or was it just as a friend helping friends out? Sort of.
It was an investment for him, but we, Richard got him up here, big night out in Newcastle, experienced everything that Newcastle has got to give.
Oh, the rest is history, right? I mean,
he's very happy and quite a lot hungover.
So.
And he wrote us a check for 15 grand, which we needed to, you know, pay the salaries. And we gave him a choice. You can have 20% interest rate, or you can have 10% of the business. Well, a year later, we gave him his interest back, 18 grand.
Really?
But if he held on to 10% of the business, he'd have done rather better. So I sometimes wonder how Simon feels about that.
Have you ever asked that question?
Oh, yes.
Over
all the time. All the time.
And his response?
Hey, unrepeatable.
I thought so.
So okay. We're running these collection of small businesses, burning cash. Richard, in particular, innovating and opening new businesses all the time.
So whilst this is the full focus, whilst you guys are really nervous cash-wise, Richard is still setting up business one, business two, business three.
So there's potentially, you can look at that either way. This is the big idea that's going to save us, or it's going to build us into a bigger hole.
Exactly. Yeah.
So one of the businesses that I'm primarily leading is a consultancy, which because it's a hangover from what I'd done before,
right.
And it's generating cash.
Of course.
So you need cash. And so looking around for ideas, as we always were, all the utilities, particularly the water companies, have recently privatized. They're all talking about going into diversification and new income streams. Quite a few of them are talking about plumbing-related services. I start pitching to the water companies, hey, why don't we do a consultancy study for you at this plumbing business you're thinking about? Instead of employing a big consulting firm to help you, why not us? Because we actually know about running contracting businesses as well. Long and the short of it is we got proposals through to all sorts of boards, none of them accepted except one. South Steps Water in Walsall said, here's a small study. Tell us what you think of our idea of setting up a small direct labor plumbing operation. So Richard and I go down, do the study, and our feedback to their board is, your idea is a terrible idea. Direct labor, ordinary plumbing business in a small part of the Midlands, terrible idea. But we've got a great idea for you. What you want is to run a big national franchise business focused on emergencies only. And what you really want is guys in yellow vans call out
you,
when I pour out the dirt.
You.
Now, that's what you need to do. It's a great plan. But you've got a problem. You're a dozy old utility. You haven't got any entrepreneurial management.
Right.
We know where you can get a business just like that. And what's more, you can get it for free. And we did a deal which we said, okay, in exchange for a bit of working capital, you can have 50% of the business.
Wow.
And they said yes. I don't think they quite realized the cash burner that it was. But anyway, the deal was done. It took 2 years to get it signed, but we acted on it straight away.
Wow.
We moved the business down to Walsall because unfortunately that's where we had to go to. Richard moved to Walsall.
Wow.
And they then grew FastFix from a small regional loss-making plumbing business into a big national loss-making plumbing business.
Okay.
So we built that, we dug that bigger hole.
Can I ask
you? Using their cash.
But at the point that they agreed to invest.
At that point, our losses stopped because they were funding the cash.
Sure. How many professional plumbers was the business employing at that moment? Just so I understand the scale.
Small, I imagine it was six.
Right. So yeah, very, very small.
This is a business concept, very small.
That's right. So they bought into the idea.
We've got a big idea, big business plan, of course, but very low cost of them.
Gee.
And there is a synergy because they know about, which indeed they did, customer service. They know about financial management. And
of course, have that infrastructure, right? That
you'll best. Yeah, and it has the infrastructure. And we're saying, this is a very low cost way of getting going in the business.
Oh.
So that was the pivotal move, but it didn't make the business successful. It just made it bigger. So for a couple of years, so the original plan was, I think, to make 100,000 in the first year. We lost 100,000. Okay. In the second year, it was supposed to be making quite a bit more, and it lost 400,000. And at that stage, the South Staff board could have easily said, close this down, or we just wipe these guys' shareholders out, which they didn't do. And fortunately, and as ever, we were looking for ways to pivot.
Oh, the next thing.
The next thing. But this time, we got it right. So following on from the, copying other people's ideas, which is building other people's learning, we could see that there were other water companies that were offering warranties against plumbing leaks. And that was a bit of a eureka moment. Richard, who was running the business in Walsall, we researched it just amongst the focus groups, first of all. And then he did 1,000 mail shots of to see whether people would buy insurance against having a plumbing leak. He got something like a 3% response rate, and that was the eureka moment. Because guess what? We're selling peace of mind. And instead of instead of selling to the exclusively to the 16% of people who had a plumbing emergency, if you could find them and get paid for it, we're selling to the 86% who don't have a plumbing emergency and who pay you cash up front. And that was transformational. And it's really the difference between being able to send a mail shot and you lose money in year one and a mail shot and it makes money within 12 months.
Totally.
And when you can do that, then you just need energy and money.
That's right. It is then volume, isn't it?
And volume. And from that moment on, a big, predictable, scalable, profitable business was created. And Fastfix Plumbing became HomeServe.
And there's a few things in there I'd love to just reflect on, Jeremy. So it seems that you, Richard, and that large water company were continued partners. And it sounds like the relationship was positive, despite, you know, being a loss-making business for too long. At what point did you three shareholder groups sort of sit down and talk about a need to reposition and rebrand? And was it you and Richard who led that?
It was Richard who led that.
Richard.
Yeah, okay. I mean, Richard and I would talk about everything. And we were equal shareholders in every sense. But he was the CEO running the company.
Understand. And your role at that point?
Non-exec.
Non-exec.
Non-exec, yeah.
So were you acting as a non-exec, i.e. you were not involved day-to-day in the running?
No, I was. I had no executive responsibility. I mean, right. I went down to the board meetings and so on.
Okay, but
your main, or more like it was, Richard and I spoke every day. As we had done over the previous 3 years.
Yeah, you can influence, can't you, in many ways.
Because otherwise, you know, he had a pretty lonely existence managing a PLC on one side, as well as trying to operationally run the business. Yeah,
exactly. Okay.
So, and the all suggestions about how the business would develop came from Richard primarily. So South Taft didn't bring anything to that.
So were they very much a passenger, if I may?
Well, I think that's a little unfair in the sense that they were such important partners.
But yes.
As far as managing is concerned, absolutely. So it's a separate business unit run by, called initially Fastfix and then HomeServe, run by the CEO and its board. So they were board members and investors.
Sure. Understand.
Yeah. And presumably. Even their offices originally.
Right. Okay. So yeah, they really were truly supporting the business.
And it's only because HomeServe became bigger.
Yes.
And then South Staffs, that suddenly it wasn't a water company anymore. And we moved the position on the stock market and rebranded and then sold the water company. So we swallowed it rather than it being spun off.
Yes. Presumably that company funded not only the period of losses that you talked about, but also the repositioning, the rebranding, and the working capital to scale the business, right? Until it became cash generative, is that right?
But it became cash generative very quickly.
Yeah.
It's an extraordinary difference how changing the cash dynamic changes everything.
Yes.
Suddenly, you can do all the right things.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know,
it didn't need any further funding. I mean, I'm not saying that there was other funding that was produced for other things.
Yes.
But broadly, this became a cash generative creature.
Yeah.
And it remains it today.
Yes. Conscious there might be things you can and can't say, Jeremy. So let me ask an open question. So from the point in time that the business pivoted.
Yeah.
To the point in time whereby you shareholders started to think about the value of it and how you take the value out of it. Mm. What was that period of time, please?
We didn't have much choice initially, because to get this deal, we had to not only give 52%, actually, to start with,
mm-hmm.
but we had to agree to two further tranches of purchases that would have taken us together down to only 24%.
Right, got it.
And that was at a 5 PE. So actually, in the end, because we needed, we requested and they agreed to extend the time, because I wasn't making much money, it was just upturning, became a 4.5 PE. So the bulk of our shareholding, they bought extremely cheaply early on. So we didn't have much choice about that. But as I often say, you know, it's better to have a little of a lot rather than a lot of a little.
Totally.
In the end, that was all perfectly worked out very well. And after that, I took some decisions relatively early on to take some further shareholdings off because I wanted to do other things because I'm an exec.
You weren't an exec.
And I was pursuing other interests. Richard was never a seller. It was his dream, his life. He drove it. And he, in fact, at one stage, he borrowed quite a bit of money to add to his stockholding. I did not because I wanted to do other things.
Hmm.
Whilst a smart investor, even in purely financial terms, I would make made a lot more money if I'd never done anything else. I'd gone lay on a beach and never took any money off. But life's not like that.
No.
Money has to have a purpose, has to do something useful. And I wanted to do other things in the same way as I wanted to set up my own business. I wanted to do other things. So I, at various stages, took some money off. I remained for the full 30-year stretch as a bizarrely a non-executive on the executive team and felt fully informed about everything that's going on. But increasingly, as the business got to be a major international PLC with lots of highly talented management, in the last 10 years, I would have added very little value, I felt, compared to, as some would say, as most non-execs don't. I'm just a very well-informed one. As opposed to in the early years where we shared every decision.
Totally.
And that was a natural progression. And it would also take up less of my time, which was what I wanted. Because sadly, life goes by.
Of course it does. That's right.
If you've got anything else you want to do, you
do
get on with it.
That's right. So two quick questions on the sort of material journey of HomeServe, because we could spend an hour just talking about perhaps chapters within the HomeServe journey, but sadly this podcast will not afford that time. So two quick questions. First of all, the market cap of HomeServe today is, just for context?
Well, the market cap when it sold, which is public information, which would have been about 18 months ago, was a bit over $5 billion.
Yeah, which is incredible. And, you know,
started it on a credit card with 10 grand.
Phenomenal.
It's quite a good ROI.
It is. It is. And my last question, which you might not be able to answer, but I'll ask it openly so you can answer it in a way that you're comfortable. Obviously, building a business of that significance not only is just so inspiring because few people do that, but of course, economically, it creates probably financial independence beyond what most people could ever really truly envisage, despite ambition and hope. Ultimately, how much have you and Richard made out of the HomeServe journey, if we call it that? And again, feel free not to answer that in the end, if inappropriate.
I probably won't. You could look Richard up in the Book of the Rich. So it's put him into being a major player. He's a very wealthy guy, I've done very well as well.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And it's honestly, genuinely, as an advisor to business and as a business person myself, it is just inspiring because to create a business of that operational significance, let alone its financial performance.
I think that was more significant.
It's just so incredible.
I mean, I think particularly, we were equal partners starting out, but Richard ran the business.
Yes.
So I frankly took the role of an investor, an advisor, really. For the second half of that journey. But it was creating a business from scratch that becomes, employs more than 10,000 people, is successful in multiple countries, and becomes a FTSE 100 company, is very unusual. I don't think you'll find many chief executives who've gone from startup to that.
No.
So that is a fascinating
bit. It is. I agree.
I was a participant in it and an observer of some of it. So it was a great experience, and obviously has given me financial independence as well, but more likely the freedom to do other things.
Yes.
Because it's not about what you consume. I probably don't consume much more than I consumed 20 years ago or 40 years ago.
Sure.
So it's not about that.
No.
But it gives you the freedom to decide what else do you really want to do, and then to try some things.
Of course it does. Before we talk about what you have pursued as a consequence, perhaps, of some of the financial independence you've created through HomeServe and the experience, wisdom, knowledge that you garnered, I'd just like to congratulate you and Richard again on building such a phenomenal business in HomeServe. Obviously, you were a non-executive at HomeServe on the executive board. Another podcast, another day, perhaps. Talk to me about what you were then deciding to do next on a more full-time, all-engaged basis.
Given we're here in the Northeast, I spent quite a lot of time doing things I just thought were very interesting. Getting involved in the Northeast Local Enterprise Partnership. I was quite heavily involved in the Conservative Party for a while. I was head of the Voluntary Party nationally. I sat on the board around David Cameron's time. So I was dabbling. I was involved in quite a few charitable things. So I was dabbling doing lots of interesting society things, which I enjoyed, whilst also dabbling around in a whole series of other investments. More recently, I developed a much clearer strategy and decided that what I really want to do now is focus on making private equity investments into SMEs.
Oh.
So it's finding small entrepreneurs at a particular stage of their development when money and support can make the difference of whether they really scale up.
Oh.
And I pick that because it's very interesting, because it's underserved, and it's not well served, and because that's when you can add most value.
Yeah, as you and Richard experienced
to go on the journey. So we're looking at companies that might be making, from £250,000 to £2 million or something. But at least they have established a business.
Yes.
They know what they're doing. They've achieved that level. But it's going on the journey to making £5 million plus, so that the business becomes much more significant and impactful for them, for their employees, the society, for everything.
Yes.
And that I think is a very difficult market because what you see happening is either they can't raise money, surprisingly, or it's funds that offer, they want to put in too much money, or they want to press them to go too hard, or they want them to borrow too much money. And fundamentally, they want to make money and return it to their investors. We do not. We are looking to say, let's go on a long journey together. Let's compound over the long haul and try and have a forever founder. We make investments. I don't necessarily want to sell them. I'd like to go as long as the entrepreneur wants to go. That way, the entrepreneur will have a much bigger and more successful business, because the money gets made in the long haul.
And it's interesting because that thesis, Jeremy, fundamentally is, tell me if I'm wrong, but it feels like it's just a direct reflection of the HomeServe journey. I.e., what made that business successful, and as a consequence, that's what you're trying to provide to founder CEOs in their businesses.
The founder CEOs, they know their business. I don't.
Exactly.
Never pretend anything else. But I do think the support that enables someone, for example, to take some money off the table.
Yes.
As opposed to being forced to sell their business.
Yeah, there you are.
Most investors will not do secondaries. They say they don't want to do that. I did it myself, and I absolutely believe it can work.
There you are.
Making sure that the employees and the key staff are rewarded appropriately so they want to stay with it. So taking the long-term decisions, not to try and beef up the bottom line so that you can sell it and you know, perhaps try and sell it to somebody at a higher price, but to say what will produce long-term, sustainable, winning business. Where is the competitive edge? And no guarantees of success, but that is feels, and I it's really enjoyable. It's really interesting. That's what I find very, you know, worthwhile to do. And it's where I think we have some competitive edges over, you know, the rest of the market.
Yeah, and it comes back to what you said right at the beginning of the podcast, Jeremy, which is to set up a business, you have to do something that the rest of the market's not doing for it to be successful.
Yeah.
Hence, Middleton Enterprises.
And be ready to pivot.
Oh.
So we change
moving
many times. So there's nothing wrong with that.
Sure.
So quite often you have to evolve a bit. But where I'm trying to invest with somebody who knows what they're doing. And the most important thing is predictability.
Sure.
If you've done something five times, then I think there's a strong possibility that you can do it another five times.
That's right. I'm better.
And then do it another five times, another five times. Then do the compounding and the math. And that's attractive. Now I'm investing in simple businesses, businesses I can understand.
Can you give examples of some of the businesses that Middleton Enterprises have invested in, Jeremy?
No, that's absolutely fine to do. So around here, for example, there's a very good example in a low-cost gym chain called One Gym, run by the Pearson brothers, running a a really effective low-cost gym. Low-cost gyms, there's some tailwinds. It's pretty good. And when we first worked with them, I think I'm right in saying they had four gyms, and they're adding three or four a year. And that is a business that was modestly profitable and is much more profitable now, and is probably now the market leader in the Northeast, and can and is, I believe, turning into a very successful business in the Northeast of England. In fact, it's just won an award last week for being one of the top 10 fastest growing companies in the North of England. But you know, these guys are the ones who run the business. They still lay the floor there. I mean, and guess what? They're running a low cost operation. Their customers are very happy, and they are opening new sites, redeveloping them. People are employed to do that. People are getting the service, employing more people, paying the taxes. That's what makes a difference. And we invest in about seven different companies like that. Different types. Different types.
Understand. And with one eye on time, I've got one question, if you don't mind. Obviously now, as an investor, I guess you and Middleton Enterprises are empowering, supporting, directing, helping owner managers in scaling their businesses.
Yeah.
Do you think that you in the future may found other businesses, or do you think the days of setting up a business and starting with a blank piece of paper are behind you?
No, I wouldn't do that. I think I'm a better investor than I am an operator. Operating is extremely hard. It's your life if you're the CEO and nothing but. I don't want to do that. And I don't necessarily think I'll be particularly good at it. There are plenty of people better. And I haven't got enough time. It takes 10 years to make a successful business. I am operating a business. It's a private equity business, which is partnering with, you know, no more at any point in time than 10 businesses. That's enough.
My last question for today, Jeremy, and this is a question that I'm asking almost on behalf of every viewer watching this podcast.
Both of them, eh?
That's right, all two of them. And one of them's my mum, which is, you know,
good answer.
In itself.
I'm sure we've reached some mass audience. Very happy to do so.
Indeed. So obviously there'll be a lot of people who perhaps are in the position you were in when you were at P&G,
yeah.
In employment, they've got a big itch and they want to scratch it.
Yeah.
They may have a friend, a colleague, a business partner like you had in Richard,
yeah.
which is brilliant, but they might not have the idea.
Yeah.
And of course, without a brilliant business idea, you have no business.
Yeah.
And of course, most businesses that fail are entrepreneurs who've forced a business setup. And of course, it wasn't a good business because it was me too. What would your advice be for any sort of budding entrepreneur who's desperately keen to set up their own business, but they just don't know doing what and what would be successful? What advice would you give them?
It's interesting. I think it's a very common situation. My main advice would be, by the way, just start. The risk is far less than you think. And when you look back on your life, you will be glad that you tried. The risk is less because, fine, if it doesn't work out, you'll go back to what you were doing before. Probably do rather better with the experience. Now, as far as the issue of don't know what to do, we didn't know what to do. But ask yourself, what do you like doing? What do you know about? Or what do you currently do? And then think, how could you do that a bit better? Because looking for some golden solution, you're not going to find it. There's lots and lots of clever people trying to think how to do something better, but there are a lot less people actually doing it. And when you're doing it, you'll know how to do it better. There's nothing you can do apart from start, I mean, unless you're, you know, Steve Jobs or something. And most of us aren't. And we weren't. And we pivoted and tried and tested and tried, and we had no choice and we were determined. And in the end, you could say you got lucky, but I think we thought we were unlucky an awful lot of times before we got lucky.
Yes.
So who knows?
No. I said that was my last question.
Mm-hmm.
I misled you. This is my last question. Obviously, you know, your journey has been really interesting. And as you say, lots of highs, lots of challenges, lots of obstacles, which you've overcome. What is the one thing that you absolutely believe today has been the most important ingredient in achieving the success that you have? Acknowledging there'll be many things, but what is the thing, the ingredient that was required to produce the successful businesses that you have done?
Persistence. Persistence pays.
Jeremy, on that note, thank you. It's been a really brilliant hour with you. Thank you for being on my podcast. And I really hope that not only the viewers find this as inspiring and as interesting as I have, but for sure, I know that as a consequence, certain founders who are scaling their businesses, who are looking in excitement for the future, but need investment and guidance, may be in touch. So for now, Jeremy, thank you.
That's great. Always happy to chat. Thanks.
It's been brilliant to have Jeremy Middleton on my podcast today. There are a lot of key takeaways from the time I've spent with Jeremy on my podcast, but the key ones for me are twofold. First of all, Jeremy said that without doubt, the one ingredient that has been essential to him throughout his entire career to this point has been persistency. Never give up, and at the face of adversity, dig deeper. I think the other key takeaway for me is for anyone who's either employed or anyone who perhaps has a business, but their business is perhaps not performing to the extent anticipated. Don't wait for the next big idea. Don't sit and navel gaze, because looking for the next big thing might fundamentally result in you looking indefinitely. Get on with it. Be inspired. Be willing to perhaps do something that in the first instance does not work. Building a $5 billion business requires mistakes to be made. And I guess a mistake is when you learn. You have been watching Confessions of an Entrepreneur/Founder, powered by RG. This podcast, along with many other podcasts with other successful investors, business people, and entrepreneurs, can be accessed not only by YouTube, but wherever else you download your podcasts from. But for now, my name is Carl Swanspring. You have been watching Confessions of an Entrepreneur/Founder, and I really look forward to seeing you, our viewers, on our future podcasts.